Welcome to Season 7, Episode 11 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Wednesday the 11th of June and we're going to discuss what's been happening in the news and in the Ubuntu community. If you're listening live, you can send us messages using the chat thing on the website and in the hash UUPCIRC channel. Why did I say hash? I never say hash. I'm Alan and joining me this week is Tony. Hello, Tony.
Good evening, Alan. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad at all. Good.
Good.
All the better for seeing you and your beard. and Mark, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Have you enjoyed that cake?
Yes, it was very gingery.
Good.
And Jamaican.
And you finished it. You're not going to eat it during the show, are you?
I've got a few crumbs.
Got some crumbs there. You can nuzzle.
Ah, that's Laura. Hello, Laura.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yummy cake. You didn't make it, did you?
Not this time, sadly.
Okay, cool. Still yummy. Should we just get on with it?
Yeah, why not?
Sounds like
a fun-packed show.
And now it's time for the news. Version 1.0 of Docker, the portable virtualization container platform thing, has been released.
You sounded so credible until you said thing.
Well, I made up those words because they were the best way I could think of describing it.
What is it then?
It's sort of like, you know, like Linux containers.
Yes, LXC.
So that gives you like a, not actually a virtual machine, but like a container on your system so that you can run another, you know, like a virtual application
inside it,
inside
containerized.
Yes, exactly. So Docker is like that, but then makes those portable between systems more easily. So you can have Docker, you can have a server running Docker and another server running Docker, and you can have a container and you can take it from one to another quite easily, which is good if you're doing like cloud deployments and scaling up and things, you know, all that mon jazz that the kids like to do.
And they've got a hosting repository, haven't they, where you can put them in and share it.
Exactly. So once you've containerized an application, then you can like get them off,
make
this.
It available to other people so they can deploy whatever your application is inside Docker. And so it's a hit 1.0. Is that significant?
Well, that they basically said that's their sort of milestone for API stability. So it means that, you know, future releases are going to be backwards compatible with what works with 1.0.
And is this something vaguely interesting to people who have Linux on their laptop at home, or is this really just for DevOps and cloudy people?
I think it's both, really, because I think the idea is that you could start it at a sort of single machine scale, and then you can sort of
scale out.
I really hate this terminology, but you know, scale out your deployment to, you know, server farms, clouds, etc. And Google seem to like it as well. They've said that they're going to integrate it with Google App Engine and Google Compute Engine, which are their sort of cloud platform as a service things.
So I could, in theory, develop my web app, whatever it might be, on my local machine, not having any account with anyone anywhere, using Docker on my local like Ubuntu LTS box, do all my development offline, and then at the point when I want to test that out, I could deploy it to a cloud of choice, and that could be Google App Engine.
That's my understanding. Yes.
Yeah.
Huh.
I think you don't have to use their repository; you can create your own.
I'm still no clearer on any of that.
Oh, bless. Well, don't worry. We've got some gaming news coming up later, Tony, so you can show off your knowledge.
My time to shine.
In that realm. Yes.
Good stuff.
Moving on in security news, another serious security flaw has been found in OpenSSL. It's like every episode so far this season.
Well, now they're actually auditing the code. They're finding lots of problems.
Now someone's actually looking at
Shock
it.
Shock horror.
Yes. So the flaw allows attackers to force OpenSSL to use a weaker cipher in its encryption algorithm. So OpenSSL supports multiple cipher algorithms, and you can force it to use a weaker one that has a vulnerability in it. Is that right?
Or just a weaker one, which is easier to crack.
Ah, okay.
For example. So, yeah, there's like a handshake it's supposed to do. And at one point in there, you can tell it which cipher you want it to use. But there was a vulnerability where it was accepting that instruction at the wrong times, which meant that you know, an attacker could essentially tell it to change it without you knowing.
Ooh.
Or tell it to, yes. And then it could crack, crack more easily the encryption by, perhaps by using a cipher which was weaker, or by using one which had a known flaw in it or something.
Huh. Has this been fixed?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. So it was found by developer
Masashi Kikuchi.
Oh, cool.
Kikuchi.
Who discovered the flaw and published a detailed blog post about it, including how and why they discovered it.
Goes back a long way as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's been...
Don't they all? Well, it's like, don't
16 audit, years.
Yeah, don't audit your code for 16 years and then suddenly start auditing. You're going to find these things, aren't you?
Yeah.
You're going to have a bad time.
But yeah, I think the way the developer describes it was basically they sort of started trying to implement a reference implementation of the spec and then compared that to how OpenSSL had done it and then noticed, oh, wait a minute, they've done this wrong.
That's really good. That's quite a neat way of identifying bugs by re-implementing their API and then discovering, I like that.
Potentially quite slow, though.
Yeah. Clearly had some time on their hands.
But then 16 years isn't, you know.
And counting, Alan Solomon, the man behind 90s antivirus software Dr. Solomon's, has said that antivirus software no longer works. He claims that the number of new malware definitions released every day is too high and therefore affecting the quality of the software. When he released his software, there would be months where no new malware appeared. Now, 1,000. Now, 100,000 a day plus new malware samples are discovered.
Wow.
That's quite a lot.
So, okay. Right. So I remember ye olde, you know, sitting in my rocking chair, thinking back to the early days of PCs and viruses.
Yes.
When, you know, we used to get a new version and there would be antivirus updates, but the machines weren't internet connected. So it wasn't like we'd get an update every day or anything like that. We would get a floppy disk in the post periodically and it would all fit on that 1.4 meg floppy disk. And then, yeah, it's kind of accelerated. Is that because we're finding them? Surely it's just that there are more people out there who are proficient in hacking on stuff that is defined as malware, which, you know, viruses, but, you know, any evil stuff that could be a keylogger or whatever.
It's probably easier to catch them as well because you're always online.
Mm. And easier for them to distribute it as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And there are virus toolkits out there, so somebody can download a virus-making toolkit, put their name
really?
In it. Yeah. Yeah, wow. like sample
Isn't
source code
cheating?
For viruses and things. Well, yeah, but it doesn't stop them doing all the damage. No. So,
I'd imagine those are somewhat easier to spot, though. You know, if it's using some kind of framework, it's going to be generating code that's possibly got signatures that are easier to recognize. So some of the decent antivirus would at least...
Yeah, absolutely.
They're the rubbish coders, though.
Well.
Yeah, there's always the good ones. That's the trouble. But yeah, so Dr. Solomon, Alan, has a good name, has done the sensible thing and switched to Linux.
What does that say? But yeah, the guy who like made a ton of money on, I assume, on antivirus. Well, you know, made some money, I'm sure, on antivirus.
Yeah.
Decided that that was, you know,
enough.
Or it's just a really good way of kind of cutting off your competition at the point where you sort of go, oh, well, it's going down. I can't hold this much longer. And just blow everyone out of the water.
Well, he sold the company, I think, back in the late 90s.
Yeah, so
he doesn't have a commercial interest in it anymore. But yes, he says there doesn't seem to be too much malware for Linux. I don't know why. Some people say it's because Linux's security is better. Some say it's because fewer people use it. I'm not really bothered.
So, fair enough.
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting. I think, you know, he's right. And we've talked about viruses before and the fact that, you know, looking at my laptop, I just realised I don't actually have any antivirus software on this laptop.
I don't on this one.
I kind of think sometimes whenever this subject comes up, I do worry a tiny bit.
I have one on my work machine.
Right.
Because
is that
I
Linux
have to.
Or is it?
On Ubuntu. Yeah.
But that's your corporate desktop that's deployed and they manage that for you.
Yeah.
So, you know, as long as you've got the little icon in the corner that says...
As far as I know, there's an icon there. I don't know why. He's never told me there's a virus.
Three lines of Python behind that icon.
Yeah, I should get onto Anton about that. But it's never found any viruses for me. But it wouldn't, would it?
No.
But then I've never noticed a virus on this one either, so... Ah. I don't know how I'd spot one, but I've never noticed one.
My mother-in-law phoned me up today and she was asking about, she told me she's worried about her desktop PC because it's running Windows XP. Mm. And she says, I'm really worried about it because it keeps popping up and telling me I'm no longer protected and I don't know what to do and should I, you know, I, I'm worried, should I go and buy a new PC or upgrade it? Or yeah, it's quite old and crusty, and you know, and the computer, not my mother-in-law, and
just let's get that clear.
Yeah, otherwise, you know, and you know, I just wondered what, you know, what does everyone else do in that situation? Is everyone just like, you know, upgrading, throwing their computers away, or
it seems to be go to the computer shop, get sold something.
Yeah, I've got that to look forward to.
Yeah. You're not going to make a mum-in-law Ubuntu then?
No.
Right, glad we cleared that.
It rolls off the tongue less well. Okay, so phone manufacturer Meizu have spoken out about their development of Ubuntu for the phone, the MX3. Apparently, Ubuntu currently lacks certain hardware drivers required for the phone to be ready for consumers. So the OS will be released for it. What?
He said, yeah. Sort it out, Alan.
Yeah. So the OS will be released for existing owners of the phone, presumably so you can do it yourself.
Well, that seems to be what they're saying. They're going to basically provide an installer for the phone, which might be able to, by the sound of it, do a full sort of replacement or a dual boot setup.
Yeah.
We, I mean, we've one of the guys, I think it was a kind of, you know, one of those Friday afternoon projects that a couple of the guys created, the dual boot installer for Ubuntu. So you can have an Android phone like a Nexus 4 and dual boot between Ubuntu and Android. And that seems quite popular. So people like that because, you know, the Ubuntu side is a bit cutting edge and maybe doesn't have all the applications that they need, so they can flip back to Android when they get a bit scared or when they need Spotify or whatever. It's interesting that this is a phone manufacturer who are kind of validating that as a process of, well, here's an image and, you know, you could put it on your phone because it is your phone.
And that way someone might write them own driver.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, there could be community contribution for people out there who already have an MX3. But actually, I think because Canonical are talking to Meizu and have a deal with them of some kind, I think that's being worked on anyway. So it's interesting because they make interesting phones that have stuff like dual SIM. So that's, you know, interesting for some people who like the idea of having a, you know, personal SIM and a work SIM in the same phone and being able to switch between them and that kind of stuff. And yeah, that stuff's being worked on as well. Cool.
Excellent. Well, I think that's all the news.
Time for the gaming news,
Tony. We've still got 5 minutes.
We've got a bunch of gaming news going on.
I think we're just about out of time.
No, we're not.
No, we're not. We're looking at the clock as we speak. And others, there's...
Stop filibustering, Tony, and speak.
Left.
Can't see the clock. I don't
know. I can.
So okay. Tell us about the gaming news.
There is some gaming news, apparently. You guys will already be familiar with all this, but... Yeah. With more than double the crowdfunding target requested, Superhot, a game initially made in a 7-day jam, the best kind of jam, is coming to Linux and inferior platforms like Windows and OS X. The game features an interesting new dynamic where time only moves when you do. So while it's a first-person viewpoint game, you're able to dodge bullets, sort of like in The Matrix.
Yes, it's really cool. I tried it out. It's on Kickstarter, as you know, and I downloaded it. They've got a Linux version. They've got a version you can play in their Unity web player. And I thought, oh, no, the web player isn't available for Linux. And then I scrolled down a little bit, and it says, looking for a Linux build? Click here. There's a little zip file. You download it, and you've got a local build.
So do you have to, at the moment, do you have to contribute to the Kickstarter to get... to download the game?
No, not to get the trial that I had a play with.
Right,
but yeah, they've got. I think they're asking for $100,000, and they got $212,000 so far, and they've got.
Okay.
At the time of recording, there's only a couple of days left to go.
Right.
It's quite an interesting concept for a game, and quite good fun.
And. Yeah, thanks for your input on that, Alan. I don't think...
Sorry, I didn't mean to usurp Tony Gaming News.
Didn't really add much, did it, really? Steam has hit the big 500 for Linux games. So 500 Linux games on Steam is the other way of looking at that.
Quite a lot.
That's
how big's the whole Steam catalogue?
Oh, it's big. Yeah.
Big, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know, actually. It's lots. It's thousands.
I was just going to say that myself.
Sorry, Tony.
Keep jumping in, don't you?
Yeah, I know.
And including in the sort of Steam-related news, Civ 5 is now available on Linux through Steam OS, thankfully.
That's
Sid Meier's Civilization 5.
And it's on special offer at the moment. It's £11 something for the full kit and all the DLC and all the extras and stuff. All the game alone is just a few quid.
But you want the DLC, don't you?
You do, yeah, for all the additional levels or whatever you call them, Tony.
Well, I call them levels.
And if you're not familiar with the series, you can also get free Civ to sort of play around with the content. It's all right. I never really got the hang of Civilization type games myself, but
what about you, Tony?
Have you ever played Civilization, Tony?
Never stop.
Right, I thought so.
I'm playing it right
now.
I actually
there's a couple of guys I chat to on Mumble, and one of them said when he saw the Civilization was available, he said, "I think I might have to get that." And in another conversation, he was talking about writing apps for Ubuntu Touch. And then today when I spoke to him, he said, bad news, I bought Civilization 5 and it's completely halted any development I've done of any apps for Ubuntu Touch because it's just consumed 3 hours of my morning, woke up at 6 o'clock and then just started playing straight away. So, it seems like it's quite a good game. So,
Excellent.
Any more gaming news, Tony?
No, that's a lot, I'm afraid.
Okay. I think that's the end of the news.
The Ubuntu podcast needs you. Yes, you. If you hear something that tickles, titillates, or taunts you, tweet us at UUPC or email podcast@ubuntu-uk.org. You can also talk to us on the telephone, Skype, Facebook, and Google+. Find links to all these places on our website, podcast.ubuntu-uk.org. We really would like to hear from you, so go on, do your duty, keep calm, and compose an email.
And now for some community news.
And
events.
Mark woke up.
So it's currently, I think, Ubuntu...
Open thing.
Yeah.
What's it called?
Online Summit.
That's the one.
UOS.
Yes.
It's got less of a ring than UDS.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, I think we need to work on that. It's been yesterday, at the time of recording, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So we're in the middle of it now. It's a bunch of sessions like the online UDS that we've done before.
Yeah.
Where we have sessions for planning, forward planning, and also some of them that are kind of announcements of letting people know what the plans already are that have already been decided, and progress reports and updates and stuff. So there was a session today where they were talking about the convergence plans and the Unity 8 desktop and things. There was a Q&A session about MIR and Unity 8 and all that kind of good stuff. And all of it's done via Hangouts on Air, so they're all archived on YouTube. So you can go back and watch them later, which is quite cool.
So has anything particular been announced this time?
No, there haven't been like big announcements or anything. I think that's one of the things that we've lost with not having UDS. It used to be that at UDS it was like a developer summit, and then it turned into a developer summit, and there were product announcements and big reveals at the start, and Mark would do a keynote speech, and he would announce the plan forward and stuff. And we've kind of lost that as we've gone back to having just like planning meetings, developer meetings, Q&A sessions and all that kind of stuff, which I think is a good thing really, because we get back to actually doing work rather than bothering about great grand announcements and stuff.
Interesting.
The community donations funding report for the 2013-14 financial year has been published, and there's lots of money left over.
Maybe they should give it to
us.
No, the FF, the one that funded all those mentorship projects and then ran out of money.
Gnome Foundation. Yeah, that's not going to happen. this is the money that comes from the community budget, which... in part, I think, comes from the donation button. No, the donation thing on the website. When you download an ISO and you get a little slider, and it used to give you a little skull when you chose zero.
<That's> a bit harsh.
Yeah, there was like it's like little sliders for how much do you want to give to the community, how much do you want to give to infrastructure or something, and
Alan's expenses fund.
Exactly. And you could slide them all up and down. And as you slid them up and down, I mean it's still there now. If you go to ubuntu.com/download and you hit the download button, you move these sliders, and down the bottom it gives you a fun little icon and a description of what that money could buy you. You know, so it's like a cup of coffee in Starbucks or a T-shirt or something.
Tesla.
Yeah, you'd have to slide them all across and then probably add a few more and then slide those across as well. But yeah, it gives you little ideas. But if you slide it all down, it used to give you a little skull, which was removed. And now it's just a little sad face, man. That's sad. But some people do donate. And some of that money goes to the community budget. And yeah, I think Mark Hall published the accounts, basically, of where the money went.
It's nice to have that sort of transparency around those donations, so that people who do donate can see where they go.
Yeah, I mean, people have been asking for it for a while, and it was one of those things that nobody quite got around to doing. And then eventually, you know, we just beat someone up and got them to do it. But it's interesting to see where the money goes and see that what kind of things people are asking for, like, you know, flights to go to conferences and...
phones.
Yeah, people asking for hardware for doing development, or if they're doing a trade show or something and they want to have handsets that they can demo Ubuntu Touch on or like that. People have put in requests for that kind of stuff. And I think that there is a link in the post that tells you how you can request funds for, you know, whatever your activities are. I just found it interesting to see, you know, people being sent to various places like Academy and, you know, DebConf or whatever, and yeah, it's quite nice. Cool.
Excellent. What's up next?
Juju is now available on GitHub.
Ooh.
Yeah. That's interesting. Juju is the...
Cloud services?
Yeah, cloud orchestration. Ooh. Yeah, if you'd said orchestration, you'd have won the prize.
I don't like that word.
Oh, okay.
Well, so does it work with Docker?
I don't know. I don't know enough about Juju. But probably.
Or Docker.
Well, clearly, yeah. We should probably get George on to talk about Juju for an hour.
We have talked to him in previous seasons about it. I'm sure it's moved on a bit since then.
Yes, I think it is actually under rapid development. And one of the things they've done that this is mentioning is, move the development to GitHub rather than Launchpad and Bazaar.
Interesting. Ooh. Is that a general trend among...
A strategic direction.
...sort of Ubuntu components these days?
Not that I've seen. I've not seen anything else move to GitHub. Obviously, you know, third parties can move stuff in and out of Bazaar and GitHub, but this is the first thing that I've seen that is Canonical moving something.
Kind of makes sense, because then you'll get other companies... GitHub's flavor of the month, so if you get other companies and things writing Juju's...
So... Yeah, well, I think it's more to do with like the development of Juju itself rather than developing the charms. I mean, that would be great if you develop the charms, which are like the packages that you deploy with Juju. I think it's more getting contribution to the Juju code base itself. And I think, yes, if it's on GitHub, then probably chances are it's going to be easier for people to fork than if you say, hey, we've got this new cloud orchestration thing and it's on Launchpad. What's that? You know,
using Bazaar. What's that?
Yeah. So, you know, you never know. It would be nice to think that moving over to GitHub would accelerate the community contributions to Juju. Yeah. But then, you know, what happens if it does? If community contribution really accelerates, then that makes you question, well, what about all the other things that we do that are open source free software? Do we start moving those off to GitHub or some other, you know, Bitbucket or whatever?
Mm. Also, there's often a lot of controversy around the contributor license agreement.
Yes.
Which presumably people would need to sign if they were to have a pull request merged into the Juju repository.
I guess so.
But whereas GitHub does make it quite easy for you to fork and develop on a fork, sort of in public on GitHub.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it'd be
But you could do that on Launchpad as well. There's nothing stopping you Bazaar branching something and then pushing.
Apart from that, no one uses Bazaar.
Well, no, I mean, you were specifically talking about the CLA, and the CLA doesn't stop you doing that.
Okay, fair point.
But, you know.
Yes.
I take your point.
Yes.
Cool. And following our interview with Marte developer Martin Wimpress, did I say that right?
Yes. It is Martin, yes.
Wimpress.
Yes. Yeah, thanks. He sees the possibility of an Ubuntu Marte remix, which is in the works. From the preliminary screenshots, it uses Marte as the default desktop with the default Ubuntu theme, colours and background.
Ooh.
Yes.
This is exciting. Do you have anything to do with this, Alan?
Yes.
You said knowingly.
Yeah. So after the last, after we interviewed Martin, I had a bit of a play with Martin. I was like, yeah, this is quite good, actually. So I had a play with creating an ISO image of Ubuntu 14.04, which had Mate instead of Unity, and that worked. So I could boot 14.04 from a live CD and then install it.
Yeah.
And that was quite good fun. But Mate is not in the 14.04 default repository, but it is in 14.10. So I thought, ah, what I could do is make a 14.10 version and have it all come from the repository and not have to add any, you know, third-party PPAs or rely on any PPAs at all. It could all come from the repository like all the official flavors do, like Kubuntu does, like Lubuntu and Zubuntu do. All of their packages come from the repository. I thought that would be nice. Got chatting to Martin. And yeah, we formed a plan. He registered a domain, which is the start of every project.
The first step to success.
Yes, it is. And he made a logo, which he's very proud of. But yeah, we need a new one. If you go to ubuntu-mate.org, you'll see it. It's, you know, it's quite nice. It gets the message across. So yeah, it was really good. You know, working on that with Martin. I think he's going to kind of take over that project and work on that, but we're trying to make it so that it fits with the way all the other flavors are made, so that it's built in the same way, so that, you know, if someone wanted to maintain it or carry on working on it, they could work on it in the same way they work on any Ubuntu flavor. That's the idea.
Cool.
Excellent. And we have an event to tell you about, and when I say we, I mean Mark.
And of course the event is OggCamp.
Yay.
Hooray.
It's happening this year again.
Hooray. Yay. In Oxford.
In Oxford.
Oh, I see what you've done there.
In October.
Yeah, the fourth to the 5th of October. That's October. At the Oxford Hotel in Oxford in England.
Awesome.
So those of you who haven't heard about OggCamp before, it's a free culture-on conference which runs across the weekend, where people talk about open source software and open hardware and Creative Commons music and literature and political activism and all sorts of other stuff, really.
Banking, hacking, yeah. And all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. You can go to ogcamp.org to find out more information and get tickets. Tickets are free.
Got one.
But you can also pay us some money if you want. All proceeds go towards making the event happen. Because we're all volunteers and we don't make any money from it. There's also information about accommodation and travel and stuff. It's at a hotel, but there's also other hotels nearby and other options. Yes.
Good stuff.
If you want to help out, as I say, we're all volunteers. So if you feel like being a volunteer and you've got a bit of time and you want to help make sure OggCamp happens and is awesome, then get in touch with us and I'm sure we can find you something to do. Also, if you want to be on the crew for actually helping people out on the day, showing people around, making sure that, you know, phones don't go off during talks and things like that, then you can contact Les Pounder. He's Big Les P on Twitter. And we're also looking for sponsors. So if you are a company who likes advertising to a bunch of geeks, then get in touch and we'll tell you more about how you can sponsor OggCamp. That's oggcamp.org.
That's all for episode 11. We'll be back next week when we'll be discussing the shutdown of Ubuntu One and alternatives. And all kinds of other things. Your feedback and anything else that comes up.
A command line love, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Cake?
Yes. Is there more cake?
I don't know.
Oh.
We'll have to see if there's some next week, won't we?
Tune in, find out.
If you're listening live, don't go anywhere. There'll be another live episode along in a minute. See you next week.
Bye-bye.